3 miles away, Mrs. McCrimmon stood in the yard beside the house, watching the planes dive on Kaneohe. The McCrimmons lived on the beach, and pretty soon 27 Japanese planes came flying down the coast, so low overhead she could see the white scarves worn by some of the pilots. Her two little boys waved and waved, but none of the pilots took any notice. The Navy families on Ford Island had no time to watch and wave. The war surged all around them. Some huddled in the strong, concrete bachelor officers' quarters. Others brought Cokes and cigarettes for the men swimming ashore. Chief Albert Molter turned his home into a first aid station. He had about 40 there, all soaking wet, all covered with oil, most suffering from shock, some burned very badly. He borrowed a first aid kit from the big crate the Boy Scouts used as a clubhouse. He broke open the canned fruit and juice he was keeping in case of emergency. He raided the linen closet for sheets, towels, blankets. He gave away all his civilian clothes. He didn't expect to wear them soon again anyhow. At the senior officer's housing quarters on Makalapa, Mrs. Mayfield and her maid Fumio went next door to sit out the raid with Mrs. Earle. They were soon joined by Mrs. Daubin, the only other wife on the hill. In the Earls' living room, the women built a makeshift shelter by turning over two big bamboo sofas and piling all the cushions on top. In the course of this construction work, Fumio whispered, "Mrs. Mayfield, is it the Japanese who are attacking us?" Mrs. Mayfield told her yes, as kindly as she could. The shelters and defensive measures varied from house to house. Mrs. Mary Buethi, a young Navy wife, grabbed her children and hid in a clothes closet every time she heard a plane. At the Hickam NCO quarters, Mrs. Walter Blakey preferred her bathtub. Mrs. A.M. Townsend filled her tub with water and some pails with sand at her house in the punch bowl section of town. Mrs. Claire Fonderhide, whose husband was at sea in a submarine, sat with a .45 automatic and waited. Mrs. Joseph Coates' little boy Richard used his gun, too. He filled a water pistol with green paint and fired it all over the place. Mrs. Carl Eifler, wife of an infantry captain, couldn't find her little boy. He had completely disappeared, the way little boys will. She busied herself, packing a suitcase, filling jugs with water, emptying the medicine cabinet, all the time wondering where her child could be. He finally sauntered home, but things looked so black by now her thoughts were following a new channel. Do I allow myself and my boy to be taken, or do I use this pistol? While she tried to make up her mind, she washed the bathroom woodwork. Mechanically, other wives also went about their daily chores. Mrs. William Campbell, whose husband was in the Navy, carefully washed his whites and was hanging them on the line when an amazed Marine sentry saw her and chased her to cover. Mrs. Melbourne West, married to an Army captain, did her ironing. She had this incessant feeling that her husband would need a lot of clean shirts if there was going to be a war. As the service families nimbly adjusted to war, much of Honolulu carried on as usual. The people in close touch with the Army and Navy knew all too well by now. But for the thousands with little contact, or perhaps out of touch for the weekend, the world was still at peace. Mrs. Garnett King called her local garage. Could they wash the family car? They said they were pretty busy right now, but could take it in the afternoon. While explosions boomed in the distance, civilian Arthur Land helped transfer 20 gallons of salad from a caterer's truck to his own car. This was the day of the Oddfellows picnic. As the noise gradually subsided later in the morning, Mr. Hubert Coriel remarked to another civilian friend, "Well, that was quite a show." Then he went off to archery practice. People somehow ignored the most blatant hints. Second Lieutenant Earl Patton, off duty for the day, was out with friends in a chartered fishing boat when a plane plunged into the sea nearby. Assuming it was an accident, they headed for the spot to help the pilot. Then another plane swooped by, strafing them with machine guns. One of the party was even nicked, but Patton charitably assumed the second plane was just attracting their attention to the first. Walking home from church, Mrs. Patrick Gillis saw the side of a house blown in, figured somebody's hot water heater had exploded. Mrs. Cecilia Bradley, a Hawaiian housewife, was in the yard feeding her chickens when she was wounded by a piece of flying shrapnel. She thought it was somebody deer hunting in the hill behind her house. Mrs. Barry Fox, living on Kaneohe Bay, awoke to the sound of explosions, looked out, and saw strange-looking planes circling the base, flames boiling up, a wall of smoke. She decided it was a smoke screen test. She didn't become really alarmed until she turned on the radio at 9:30 and didn't hear the news. That was the time she always listened to the latest bulletins, and this morning there was only music. One by one, they gradually learned. Stephen Moon, a Chinese 12-year-old, was at early mass on Aleva Heights. He planned to go on to the school club picnic at Kailua. Near the end of the service, his mind began to wander, and his eyes strayed out the window. Right above Aleva Heights, two planes were in a dogfight, but that was common, and he thought nothing of it. He glanced a little to the left and saw black puffs of smoke in the sky. That was strange. He knew the practice ammunition always left white smoke. As his attention drifted back to church, he became aware of a completely changed atmosphere. Right in the middle of the service, parents were slipping in and hurriedly taking their children out. He knew there was something wrong now, for the grown-ups were whispering and acting very mysteriously. The mass ended, and instead of the regular hymn, everyone stood and sang the Star-Spangled Banner. But it was all too deep for Stephen. Still thinking about the picnic, he strolled off toward a friend's house. Then a plane roared down from the sky and shot at a car driving toward Pearl. He spun around and ran home as hard as he could. His mother was glad to see him, too. She had been looking for him everywhere. Captain Walter Barr, one of Honolulu's crack harbor pilots, also noticed the black puffs of smoke as he went out to meet the Dutch liner Jagersfontein, inbound from the west coast. The pier watchman explained it was probably the Navy practicing, but he had a curious sense of urgency when he boarded the ship at 9 a.m. No one told him anything, but he sensed danger in all that noise and smoke. He brought her in fast. They were about at the harbor entrance when bombs began to fall, and columns of water shot up around them. Since Holland was already at war, the Jagersfontein was armed, and the Dutch crew knew exactly what to do. They peeled the canvas covers from the guns and began firing back, the first allies to join the fight. A scrappy young flyweight boxer named Toi Tamanaha listened to the gunfire as he walked down Fort Street to the Pacific Cafe for breakfast around 9:30. He didn't think much of it. There was always shooting going on. Somebody in the cafe said it was war, but Toy remained unconvinced. Then somebody said all carpenters had been called to their jobs. Toy's close friend Johnny Kawakami was a carpenter, so Toy advised him to get going and sauntered off himself to the Cherry Blossom Sweet Shop on Kukui Street for a popsicle. He was just inside when it happened. A blinding blast hurled him right out into the street. Vaguely, he heard yells of help. He noticed his left leg was missing. He thought, maybe I only lost one leg. He was wrong. The other was gone, too. But just before he blacked out, it was nice to hear someone come up and say, Toy, you'll be all right. There were explosions all over Honolulu. The Lewers and Cook Building in the heart of town. The Schumann Carriage Company on Beretania Street. Kuio Avenue near Waikiki Beach. A Japanese community out McCully Street. Four Navy Yard workers were blown to pieces in their green 37 Packard at the corner of Judd and Iholena. The same blast killed a 13-year-old Samoan girl sitting on her front porch watching the gunfire. Many of the people in Honolulu later believed the explosions were bombs. Some of them still do. In the words of one witness, as the years pass, the bombs keep dropping closer. But careful investigation by ordnance experts revealed that anti-aircraft shells caused every one of the 40 explosions in Honolulu, except for one blast near the Hawaiian Electrical Company's powerhouse. In their excitement, gunners on the Tennessee, Farragut, and probably other ships forgot to crank in fuses. Other ships, like the Phoenix, had trouble with bad fuses. Others, like the Nevada, fired some shells that exploded only on contact. As one Nevada gunner explained, if the shell missed, it still had to come down somewhere. But even the shells didn't do a complete job of waking up Honolulu. At police headquarters, Sergeant Jimmy Wong's blotter reflected a good deal of consternation about the explosions. The first was a complaint phoned in at 8:05 by Thomas Fujimoto, 610 E Road, Damon Tract, that a bomb had interrupted his breakfast. But there were also more familiar entries, indicating normalcy far into the morning. 10:50 a.m. A man reported to be drunk and raising trouble at Beretania and Alapai. As the uproar increased, editor Riley Allen of the Star Bulletin gallantly struggled to get out an extra. He was a fast, if unorthodox, typist. This morning he was at his best, one hand punching madly, the other rooting out the keys that piled up in a hopeless snarl. The papers were on the street by 9:30. The headline, War, Oahu Bombed by Japanese Planes. At her home on Aleva Drive, Mrs. Paul Spangler heard the newsboys shouting extra. She had no ready change and debated whether to raid the money she set aside for church collection. She finally did. Back at the Star Bulletin office, Editor Allen got a call from an exasperated policeman. Would he recall his newsboys? They might get hurt. They had gone to Pearl Harbor to sell their papers. Anyone still in doubt learned by radio. At 8:04, KGMB had interrupted a music program with the first word, a call ordering all Army, Navy, and Marine personnel to report to duty. The call went out again at 8:15 and 8:30. By then, KGU was on the air, too, calling doctors, nurses, defense workers to report for emergency duty. The first explanation came at 8:40. A sporadic air attack had been made on Oahu. Enemy airplanes have been shot down. The rising sun has been sighted on the wingtips. This only confused many listeners who thought sporadic meant simulated. It took time to sink in, even if a person understood sporadic. Some people tuned in between bulletins, heard only a gospel service or the incidental music that was used to fill in. Reassured, they turned off their sets again. Others harked back to Orson Welles' broadcast of the Martian invasion. They weren't going to bite on this one. Webley Edwards was at KGMB by now and did his best to gear the station to the crisis. But it was hard to drop some peacetime practices that were done almost by instinct. The records played between the bulletins seemed sometimes hideously incongruous. Once the song was Three Little Fishes, a popular melody of the time that began, "Down in the meadow in the itty-bitty poo thwam three little fishies and a mama fishy too." As people continued to phone, continued to ask questions, continued to be doubtful, Edwards grew more and more exasperated. Finally, a call came from Alan Davis, a prominent businessman and a member of the station's board of directors. When he, too, asked if it wasn't really a maneuver, Edwards burst out, "Hell no, this is the real McCoy." Davis sounded really shocked, mumbled, "Oh, oh," and hung up. The effect was so impressive that Edwards decided to use the same words on the air. That might be the way to get people to really believe the news. Starting about 9 a.m., he repeated again and again that the attack was the real McCoy, so often that most people who listened to the Honolulu radio that day remember little else. As they sat by their sets, many of the listeners found themselves paying special attention to the tone in Edwards's voice. They seemed to be searching for some extra clue that would tell them how serious the situation was. Mrs. Mayfield thought he sounded hoarse with suppressed excitement. Joan Stidham thought he was tense. Edwards had at least one very disappointed listener. Sitting in the wardroom of the Japanese carrier Akagi, Commander Shinichi Shimizu turned on the radio to see how the Americans would react to the attack. Soon the announcer began breaking in with orders for different units to report to duty, but his voice was calm, and in between times the station continued to play music. It was a big anticlimax. The announcer wasn't nearly as excited as Shimizu.